With that, inspiration comes the energy. Inspiration almost always has energy coming with it. That's kind of the nature of inspiration. It is this kind of this force that makes you act. That's what inspiration is, but in a positive way, with a sense of joy and a sense of well-being. So that then becomes the natural outcome of the investigation of these suttas in the right way. So you get the energy arises, and when the energy arises, energy often comes with this joy. We've been seeing this now again and again. Rapture, it is called here. And you feel more and more joyful as you plunge into that. And now it is the meditation that starts to take over. You finished kind of your work with using the reflection on the Dhamma, and now you are using that kind of in the background to allow your meditation on the breath or whatever to carry you forward. The joy arises, and when the joy arises, then as we have seen, the same sequence we've seen before, from that joy, as you take it deeper, you gain this tranquility. And the tranquility is like this feeling sometimes. You become like this rock. You just want to sit here, you don't want to move, you don't want to do anything else in your whole life, because it just feels so settled, it feels so tranquil, it feels so happy. And you realize this tranquility is just so much more profound than all the doing, all the stuff you live in your life. And you feel like you could sit here for the rest of eternity, just like in this posture. So happy, so incredibly content. Tranquility, the opposite of restlessness, the opposite of craving, the opposite of being driven around, this inner, deep inner contentment and happiness. So when you feel like a rock, you just want to sit there, you don't want to move at all, that's a very good sign. And you're really getting somewhere in your meditation practice if you ever get to that point. And then, because this is so pleasant, and because it has a very deep and profound happiness coming with it, it draws you in, and it allows samadhi to arise as a consequence. Your mind only wants to have anything to do with this particular object. It doesn't want to go anywhere else, and because of that, you're drawn into that object, and you enter a deep state of samadhi as a consequence. And this is the jhanas especially. And that is actually one of those important points on the path, is when the suttas use the word samadhi, what do they actually mean? Because you will find that a lot of time people talk about different kinds of samadhi, and you will find things like upachara samadhi, which means something like neighborhood samadhi. In other words, it's the neighborhood of the real samadhi. Coming close to the jhanas or whatever. Sometimes you hear terms like kanika samadhi, which means something like momentary samadhi. But in the suttas, if you suttas, the word kanika samadhi and upachara samadhi never actually occur in the suttas. And in the suttas, there's only one type of samadhi that is really dominant, that you see again and again and again, and that is the four jhanas. So when the suttas use the word samadhi, if there is no explanation about what it means, you can assume that it refers to the jhana states. It doesn't always refer to that. It is a broader term, and it can mean refer to other things. But if there is no reason to, if there is no information available, you can assume that the jhanas are actually what is meant by that samadhi state. That is useful to know. So you go into some very deep and powerful states of samadhi. And this is what the jhanas are. And as I mentioned yesterday, these are really, really profound. These are about the very, very coming very close to awakening itself. So these are not states to be kind of taken too lightly, and to think that you get into jhana easily. If you get into jhana easily, probably is not the jhana states. And then you practice those jhana states, and you practice them again and again and again, and you go through the various jhanas, and at this point the path is really becoming so out of the ordinary. At this point you are probably a stream mentor already, because you've had some jhana experiences. Stream mentoring kind of happens while you're doing this, and then eventually you come to the last of all the awakening factors, which is the upeka sambojanga, the awakening factor of equanimity or evenness of mind. The mind becomes incredibly even, very solid. It becomes imperturbable. Anenja is the Pali word for introvertible. It sounds almost like ninja, doesn't it? Anenja. And that is what it is. It's like the mind that is ready to take on anything, yeah? A bit like a ninja. That actually is a good word. It fits quite well there. But it's more peaceful than a ninja. Yeah, ninja moves around too much. So this is kind of more the peaceful kind of ninja, fighting off the defilements one and the last time. I don't like the warrior similes so much. There are some warrior similes used in the suttas because they are a bit too violent and a bit too much force and effort involved. But occasionally they are used actually in the suttas, so they are not necessarily wrong. I guess it depends on your disposition whether you these things make sense to you or not. So what is upeka? And upeka is this mind when you have gone beyond all happiness and pleasure, and you have gone to the mind which only has the neutral feeling, neva dukkha, neva sukha, neva dukkha na sukha, whatever it is. It is just you have understood that even happy feelings are actually inferior to the pure equanimity of mind. So because of that, the mind becomes extraordinarily powerful. It can't really be pushed around by any kind of happiness and suffering in the world, because you have gone beyond all of that. You've gone beyond to the neutral feeling. And upeka literally means something like looking on. Yeah, you become the ultimate observer. You can observe with incredible power, incredible detail, seeing everything that is there. And at the same time, you are imperturbable. You're not moved by anything that you see. Even when you see that consciousness itself is suffering, you actually can deal with it, and it's not a problem. And then you can go beyond. But it needs an exceptionally powerful mind to be able to see that. And that is why the upeka, the onlooker, the stage of onlooking, looking on, that is the kind of ideal stage for making a final insight into all of these profound insights, non-self, suffering, and these things that are so incredibly hard to see. That is when you have the best possible mind for that. And that is why the upeka sambodhanga is kind of the final piece of the puzzle. Once that piece comes into place, you can imagine that you will become an arahant very quickly once that is in place. So that is the whole path all the way to the end. And there is nothing really beyond that. Now, the path really ends there, and then the insights pretty much come as a matter of course, as long as you have the right view at the very beginning, starting out with the right view, then the right view combined with the power of the mind in samadhi, those two things are like dynamite, and all you have to do is wait for the explosion, and bang, you become a strement, you become an arahant. The world turns upside down, and suddenly you see things in an entirely different way. You understand the emptiness of all phenomena. You understand why the five khandhas, the five upadana khandhas, are suffering, and why all of this is problematic. Why you want to get out of this eternal cycle of rebirth, and you want to make an end of it all. Everything kind of comes together beautifully here. But of course, it is a revolution, in psychological revolution, because it is a very different way of looking from what we are used to here. So that is what the bodhjhanas do for you. And now what I want to do is to have a look at one more sutta that has to do with how to recollect that Dhamma. Because we have just seen how the recollection of the Dhamma leads to this wonderful result if you do it in the right way. So what is one way of remembering that Dhamma? And one of the most obvious ways is just to read the suttas, to get the depth of what they are, and then kind of be inspired in this way. This is the obvious way. But you can also recall the Dhamma in a more general way, the power of this Dhamma and what it actually does to you. So this is what this next little passage here is about. Again, we are back now to the Mahanama Sutta that we looked at before. This is just another extract from that Mahanama Sutta. Again, Mahanama, a noble disciple recollects the Dhamma thus. The Dhamma is expounded by the Blessed One, directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable to be personally experienced by the wise. When a noble disciple recollects the Dhamma on that occasion, his mind is not obsessed by desire, ill will, and confusion, etc., etc. And it's the same thing that comes after this. Well, I'll read it out again in a second here. So, same kind of thing. Yeah, the mind gets straightened out, it gets ready, and then this whole process happens as a consequence. So what does this mean, this thing here? And this, again, is the standard way that the Buddha recommends us to recall the Dhamma. Svakato bhagavata dhammo sandittiko akkaliko ehipasiko opanaiko pachatang reditabo vinyuhi ti. Yeah, the standard way of remembering the Dhamma. So this is how, ideally, we recall this, what the Dhamma is about. So what does this mean? And well expounded, svakato, means things that we have already seen before. The idea that the Dhamma, there's nothing superfluous, there's nothing lacking. Everything is there for the path, everything matters. Every kind of, everything the Buddha taught us has some aspect of the path, and it's important to take that into account. There's nothing superfluous, nothing we can just throw out and get rid of because it doesn't matter. There is the care of the wording. One of the feelings you get when you read the suttas, and probably one of the things you may have felt as we go along with this, is how everything fits together so beautifully. It all kind of, you know, it's like kind of the teeth of wheels kind of fitting in as the kind of the wheels kind of roll, and it all kind of fits in so smoothly, like the jigsaw pieces of the jigsaw puzzle kind of clicking into place, and then the kind of the whole picture comes out. Have you got a bit of that feeling? That's the kind of feeling I get when I read the suttas. The more I understand them, the more you see how all of these things fit together so beautifully. So this is the idea of the Dhamma being svakato, and the more you svakato means su akata, and su is good. Akata is declared, well expounded. Su is one of these prefixes in Pali, S-S-U. Do is the opposite. Do means bad. So, and this is this feeling that the Buddha put a lot of emphasis into the right wording so that the meaning can be extracted as easily as possible. And once you get that, you take the suttas more seriously. You look at them more carefully. You look at the similes. You know, sometimes every word can matter or can make a difference. Of course, it is important also in this context to remember that these are 2,500 years old. And of course, over 2,500 years, there's bound to be some problems with textual transmission. That's just the way things are. Things are impermanent. Things are never going to be exactly the same. So we take a little bit of care. We don't become gullible either. And you do some comparative study and all of that to make sure you have the best possible basis for knowing what is there. But generally speaking, those things that are in common, and those things that occur many times in the suttas, will be very often very useful to contemplate in detail, and to try to understand what actually is there. The Dhamma is svakato. One of the things that always surprises me is how people very often say, in one way I can understand it quite well, people often say it's so much easier to listen to modern teachers because the Dhamma they teach is so much easier to understand than the suttas. I get that, because often a modern teacher will use a modern language. Very often they will teach. When you are face to face with somebody, there is so much more going on than just reading a text. So because of that, there's more transmission in a sense. There's a transmission of feeling and all these kind of things that come with it. And of course, that all of these things matter. But don't think, just because it feels easier to understand, just because there is a superficial kind of ease there, doesn't mean that those teachings actually are superior, or that they actually are, in the end, easier to understand. Because in the end, I have always thought, I used to think in a similar way. And I started to look at those teachings more carefully. And I realized very often there can be actually a lot of ambiguity in there. What do these teachers actually mean by these things? What is actually going on? And after a while I realized, if you really want to come to the real Dhamma, if you want to understand what these things are about, the best expression of them is actually in the suttas. It's actually more consistent, more coherent, more, in the end, it's more easy to understand than almost than any other teacher that you come across, basically. So be careful by being drawn in by superficial ease of comprehension, because here there's more profound things going on. And you get that by reading the suttas and contemplating them again and again. And then you start to see how useful they are. So the Dhamma is svakato, well expounded. There's a reason why the Buddha says that. And then he says that they are directly visible, directly visible, sandittiko, and immediate, akaliko. Okay, so maybe Venerable Akaliko should expand on akaliko. Actually, I'll probably stick with it. You can do some later on. If you want to add something, Venerable Akaliko, you can do some this evening or something. You're more than welcome to do that. And these two words are really, they are synonyms for each other. And sandittiko means visible, really in this very life. It is opposed to samparayika. Samparayika means having to do with the future life. So it has this double, beautiful double meaning. And akaliko does as well. Akaliko means that it is immediate, in other words, has to do with this life. You don't have to wait till after you die to get confirmation of these teachings. So there's two meanings to this, and one meaning is that everything on the Buddhist path can be experienced in this life. Full final confirmation of all of these truths can be had now. You don't have to wait until after you die, and that's kind of nice that it can be that way. That is a very important part of the Dhamma, but it is a little bit. It is not as useful perhaps, because it is a little bit distant still. And a more useful way of thinking about this idea of sandittika and akalika is that you can actually experience the result of the Dhamma right in the present moment. If you are able to turn your mind in the right direction right here and now, if you turn your mind towards being generous to the people around you, being kind to them because you feel that they have been good companions over the last few days, and you just turn your mind to that being generous towards them, straight away a good feeling arises inside of you. Any time that you use yonaso manasikara, a wise reflection, and you turn your mind in the right direction, the result is immediate, especially if you act upon that. Act upon that generosity, act upon that kindness. And in this way, it is immediately visible. It's similar to the idea of the Ditta Dhamma Kamma, the Kamma that is visible in this life. It is a similar kind of idea. You can feel the results of the practice here and now. And there's one story that I always like to tell on these retreats, and this time it definitely is Venerable Samidhi. This time there's no doubt about it. And this Venerable, the other one was Agivesana, I think. That's right, now it's coming to mind. Agivesana. This is Samidhi. And Samidhi is the story of Samidhi, and he is bathing in the hot springs in the Rajagaha. And I always like to point out to people that if you go to Rajagaha and you go to that place, it is at the bottom of one of the big hills in Rajagaha. Rajagaha is a really delightful place even now, big hills and all these kind of things. At the bottom of that hill there is a hot spring, and that's where this Venerable Samidhi was bathing, because monks had to bathe somewhere. Hot spring is obviously a nice place to bathe. And you go to India today, people still bathing in the same hot springs. And this on the way to Satipana cave, exactly, on the way up the hill, just at the very base there, you have the hot springs. I think the hot springs are a bit more developed now than they were at the time of the Buddha. Now they have kind of proper tiled baths and all these kind of things. But they probably didn't have that at the time of the Buddha. Probably not. But it's the same. And these are the things that kind of make India, or make the Buddhist teachings especially, come alive when you go back and you actually see exactly what is there. And Rajagaha is one of the best places to go, because the natural environment there is so spectacular and so different. And it's very easy to recognize it from the suttas, because kind of geographical formations are so obvious and so clear. You have the hills, and then you have the city in the middle. It's just so obvious that you have arrived at exactly the same place that the Buddha used to stay 2,500 years ago. And that's very powerful. Just that feeling of reality that you get when you go there is actually incredibly useful. Anyway, He is at the hot springs, this Samidhi, having a bath. There's actually another story about that same bath. And that kind of says something about India as well. This is a story from the Vinayapitaka. And this is the monks are bathing in these hot springs. Bathing away. And then the king comes. And the king also wants to bathe in the hot springs. It's kind of an interesting kind of idea of king, isn't it? He goes to the hot springs to bathe. It sounds pretty kind of ordinary here. It's not kind of, and then he comes to the hot springs and he stands there, he sees the monks bathing. And because he's a Buddhist, he waits for the monks to finish. And by the time the monks are finished with bathing in the hot springs, it's become late. So when the king bathes, after the king has bathed, he comes out. The city has closed. Yeah, they closed the doors of the city. And the king has to stay outside the city overnight. And then in the morning, the king is not so impressed with his monks who took so long to bathe. So he goes to the Buddha and says that maybe these monks can be a bit more sensitive when the king is waiting to have a bath. And then the Buddha lays down a rule about bathing. That's kind of a bit beside the point, but that's what happens. But it's fascinating because it shows you the kind of small scale of the ancient Indian society here. Here, as a king these days wouldn't go and bathe in a public hot spring somewhere. That's kind of really out of the ordinary. So he would have been a very small scale king here who used the same bathing facilities as other people and who didn't even control the closure of the gates of his own city. Who was left outside. So everything very small scale. It was a very early society in India, and everything was still developing, and this kind of puts it into context, into historical context. It gives you some idea of what that society was like, and you can compare it to archaeological excavations and all these kind of things. But anyway, so Samidhi, bathing in the hot springs, and as he comes out of the water, he's kind of drying himself and starting to put on his robes, and then as he does that, this Deva comes. And this Deva is like here, is a tempter Deva. And this tempter Deva, I'm not sure if it's a he or she, but it kind of if it's a she, it kind of makes the whole thing a bit more kind of exciting here. So this Deva comes down, and this Deva says to Samidhi, why are you wasting your time being a Buddhist monk? The sensual pleasures of the world are available for you. And you can all you can do is kind of put these robes aside and you can start enjoying yourself in ordinary life. Why are you wasting your time on these things that are not really, that are always in the future? Because all this Nibbana, all the jhanas, all of that is all so far away. It is not really in the here and now. Instead, you can leave the monastic life and you can enjoy the sensual pleasures immediately. Why are you pursuing something that is far away in the future when all of these pleasures are immediately attainable? And somebody thinks, wow, you have a point, actually. Why am I doing this? Maybe I made a big mistake. And of course, it is an interesting point, because it actually seems so obvious. It seems so obvious that the Deva time must be right, because all of you've been struggling over the past 9 days, and how many of you have got a jhana over the past 9 days, or how many of you are arahants by now? Not so many, If you had a show of hands, probably wouldn't see that many hands. So there's a point to that. We're always kind of seeking for this thing in the future, whereas the ordinary pleasures of the world, they are so tangible. They are right there. You can have a meal straight away. Relationships are always kind of, there's some satisfaction in those relationships. You can entertain yourself, whatever you want to do. All of these things are there. So Samidhi, he doesn't, not really sure what to say, but he has faith in the Buddha, so he says to this Deva, the Buddha says it is the Dhamma that is immediately satisfying, immediately attainable, whereas the sensual pleasures are always about the future. Later on, he goes to the Buddha and asks the Buddha, and this Devata is getting really, really interested now, because he or she, whatever it is, kind of realized there might be something profound going on. So he goes to the Buddha and tells the Buddha, and the Buddha says, of course, you're right. And then this Devata listens in, and hopefully they kind of get changed by that. And the answer to that conundrum, which kind of seems obvious in one way is, of course, that we saw earlier on the simile of the dream. Yeah, the idea that the sensual pleasures are always like a dream. They're like a dream because they are really always about the future. Anything that has to do with craving, with desire, is about the future. It's always about the movement towards something. And sensual pleasures is always about moving towards something else. There is like a tiny moment when you kind of enjoy those sensual pleasures, and sometimes it is not all that satisfying while you enjoy them, and then the craving comes back, and you keep on moving. It's the internal movement towards something, and never really getting to any real goal, any real purpose. So once you think about it like that, it becomes kind of obvious why these sensual pleasures are not about the present, but they are about the future. Whereas the Dhamma, as I just mentioned before, is really about the present in the sense that once you get there, once you sit down and your meditation works right, you have the yoniso manasikara, the wise reflection, suddenly your mind becomes more peaceful. And you will no doubt have seen that during this retreat. Sometimes it doesn't work, but sometimes it does work. And the reason why it works is precisely why it is good to reflect at the end of the meditation, because you will recognize why it works sometimes and why it doesn't work at other times. It is about letting go. It is about giving rise to the right kind of perception that enables you to take it deeper. It's about simple little things like that that enables the meditation to become more powerful. And the same thing with our actions in daily life, the same thing with our being generous and kind towards others. It's exactly the same thing. If you're coming from a good heart and you do these things with integrity, straight away you get the beneficial results. The Dhamma is visible right here in this life. And it's very useful, and every time the Dhamma does not seem to work, it is simply because you're not really approaching it in quite the right way. So you learn to approach these teachings in the right way, and then it starts to become incredibly meaningful. And of course, then you build up on that. You build up and up and up. And this is kind of, it is a cumulative path where everything accumulates and you get more and more out of this path as you move along. And so it's not just one little point of happiness because you're kind, but actually every time you do an act of kindness, there is a residue in the mind. It actually lifts the mind up a little bit. You have a peak experience, but also you never fall back to the same level you were before. It is a residue left, and that residue builds and builds and builds each time you do an act of kindness, each time you live in the right way. And you build yourself up, yeah? And in this way, you're moving towards this very meaningful path, very meaningful as a real goal to be found on this path, compared to that emptiness that you have in the sensual realm, where you're always forever running after something that never can be found in that realm. It promises so much, but delivers so little. So it is visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see. Same kind of idea, yeah. If you practice it, you will see the results. Applicable, opanayika. The idea of opanayika is that it leads you onward. Upanayika, nayaka is like leading. So the word for leader in Pali is nayaka, mahanayaka. These are the leaders of the sangha often. Nayaka means a leader. Upanayaka, leading you kind of forwards, onwards, towards something. So, and this is one of the reasons why it is always useful to reflect on whether you are having success in your meditation or not, and whether you are going anywhere, because it's supposed to lead you onwards. Yeah, so always ask yourself, is it going anywhere? Is it getting better from last year? If it is not, then you need to inquire why, and you will you should generally be able to find the reason why it is not moving forward. To be personally experienced by the wise. So if you haven't got the wisdom yet, you have to develop that wisdom. The good news is that wisdom can be developed, and wisdom is often very simple. Wisdom is not the ability to say a lot of Pali words. So sometimes maybe I shouldn't say so many Pali words. But it's not about these kind of things. Wisdom is often very simple. Wisdom is seen in conduct. It's not seen so much in how people speak and all these kind of things. If the conduct is right, that is where wisdom is to be seen. So be wise, and if you haven't got wisdom, build it up gradually. You already have much more wisdom than you think you have. This is why you are here. This is why you recognize the beauty of these teachings. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here unless if you didn't have that little bit of wisdom already there. So it's already inside of you. You're just waiting for that wisdom to blossom and come out. And it will if you keep on practicing this path. So don't underestimate yourself. Don't think that you are kind of stupid or you don't have full understanding or whatever. Of course, when you... You may feel that you haven't got as much understanding of these teachings as I have, for example, but that's to be expected. You shouldn't really expect to have as full understanding as someone has been doing this for 25 years, 24/7 almost. It is that takes a lot. But you have enough to make you going. You have enough to get you started and to carry on. So please don't underestimate yourself. Sometimes people don't have enough kind of appreciation of their own goodness and their own inherent wisdom. Just allow it to come out. It's there. And if you keep on going, it will eventually develop and become very beautiful as a consequence. So, this is how to reflect on the Dhamma. And then, of course, when you do that, because you're reflecting, again, you see where real happiness is to be found. You forget about all those silly things that obsess your mind, the greed and the ill will and the confusion. You leave all that behind because you know it is all nonsense, and your mind gets clarity, and you move forward as a consequence, and your mind is straight based on the Dhamma. And then when the noble disciple whose mind is straight, they gain inspiration in the meaning, gain inspiration in the Dhamma. The meaning here is the goal, the purpose, what this is all about. The Dhamma is the teaching, what the Buddha gives us. You gain joy connected with that Dhamma, pamuja. And when you're joyful, rapture arises. Yeah, now we're back to the seven awakening factors again. The rapture arises, and because you have a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. Another of those awakening factors. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. That is not mentioned in the awakening factors, but it is kind of implied. And for one feeling pleasure, the mind is stilled. Another of the awakening factors, the last two, in fact. And this is called a noble disciple who dwells in balance amidst an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted population, as one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, they develop recollection of the Dhamma. So that shows you once again how, based on the very simple idea of recalling the Dhamma in the right way, and it is not always easy because our mind doesn't fully comprehend perhaps what is going on, but the more you can do that, the more you can develop all of these wonderful things on that basis. That is the purpose of this. So, there you are. That is all for this morning, and this afternoon we will continue a little bit more with these awakening factors. So we'll see you back again at 3 p.m. this afternoon.